Hi there. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO FM 90.7 Community Radio. Our guests today are Candace Jan and Jill Falk, the two artists who opened the show called Perceive this past weekend at Killjoy Collective, which is both a gallery space on Southeast 10th Avenue in Portland and a community of local women artists. Welcome to the show, Candace, Jill.
Thanks, Eric. We're glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Jill, we'll start with you. Your work in Perceive, which will run through October 7th at Killjoy, is a series of oils on canvas that came from photographs, which do not necessarily reveal themselves immediately. In your pieces. Can you tell us a little bit about the process?
Yeah, sure. So for the past several years, I've really been interested in sort of monochrome paintings and how far this idea of ambiguity in the painting and sort of being in the space where you sort of are able to see recognizable imagery, but at the same time, you're sort of constantly questioning what you're seeing and like the reveal really becomes different depending like where the viewer is in relation to the work. So basically I like to use photographic images as source material, just as a jumping off point, like a place for me to sort of begin the process of investigating the painting as process as a way to like transform perception, like transform my own mode of perception. And in a lot of ways, using the photographic image is a way for me to disrupt my own sort of process with painting. And generally, I work with images. I archive images constantly, oftentimes from film or television or old family photographs. And over the process, the course of days, months, or years, I sort of work at transforming those, like, digitally with different programs like Photoshop or different just apps on my phone, like glitch apps. And then I sort of go back when I'm gonna start a painting or a series of paintings, and I sort of mine those and work with that image and images in different ways. And I think like for me, a lot of it is I'm always sort of thinking about like this sort of world of forms that we live in that is sort of filled with boundaries and distinctions and labels, where it's like, if we're sitting here talking, it's like, I'm Jill and I'm in a body, and like, you're Eric, a separate entity in a body, and there's tables and chairs and all these things. But if you think about levels and layers of reality, like we can go down to sort of like a quantum level of information where it's like electrons and atoms and different molecules that are interacting in really different ways. And I think that's something that I'm always sort of trying to look at in my work. A lot of it is so theoretical and maybe experiential in the sense that, I mean, you can't, like, there's not really a diagram or a map of that sort of experience, but it's the experience and the process of making the painting sort of becomes akin to that in my mind, in the sense that the work itself is not exactly representational, but there is representational information within the work, and sort of there's a layered reveal in that where it's this constant push and pull between like the background and the foreground, and the fact that the paintings themselves are so low contrast, it's hard to tell what's the background, what's the foreground, what's representational and non-representational.
You start with a very specific image, a photograph, and in different ways you manipulate that image and create something that's, as you say, much less representational, and also, as you say, open to interpretation depending on your perspective. They have an almost ghostly quality where the images forms and images reveal themselves differently, and of course everybody's going to have a sort of a different take on it. But that limited color palette with the gray is that part of how does that figure in to that sort of manipulation of the original source image? Is that part of what makes them feel sort of shadowy and ghostly? It was that part. Was that what that choice was about?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And that palette sort of evolved over the last couple of years. I started much darker and sort of with this monochromatic blue and sort of black, and then moved into really trying to. I was for a while really working trying to paint black on black, which was maddening, but it was really great because it kept pushing me into this thing that I didn't know how to do. And then it sort of evolved into the gray over time because I think it gives me a little bit more leeway in terms of like warms and cools. And it's also, I think, just even in a conceptual way, gray is something we talk about when we are talking about ambiguity and there's no real clear-cut answer or sort of solution or thing that we're looking at. We're like, oh, that's, you know, sort of a gray zone. Like we're talking about the in-betweens, and that's a lot of what I'm interested in, is sort of this in-between like space where I know something but I also don't know it. I'm sort of constantly questioning what I'm seeing or what I think I'm seeing, and it's never fully fleshed out.
Candace, you are a photographer by training and by choice, obviously, and your work in Perceive is more obviously based on photographed, well, we're going to learn that that's not precisely the right word, but photographic style images. But there's also some iterations that your work goes through before it's seen. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, right. So I start out in a different process than probably, you know, what you would think would traditionally photographing. I'm not out in the field, you know, taking an image with a camera.
Let me interrupt just for a second, sure, Candace. I'm sorry. Yeah. I should, for our listeners, what you're seeing in the show Perceive is what appears to be a series of photographs, but that's not precisely what we're looking at.
I mean, I classify them as photographic images. Sure, you know, they're printed on paper and framed. So, you know, you're looking at them as photographic images. The reason I say photographic images rather than photographs is more because it's not coming from film. It's not coming from a raw image from a camera. And I use that technology in a really specific way because I think that for me, using non-traditional lens-based materials such as scanners is a way for me to grasp the imagery a little differently. There's images in the show that are really just they're picking up a clarity that you can't necessarily get when you're at a safe distance, which I kind of define as a photographer behind its camera and its subject at, you know, a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the scanners because I feel like there's a truth behind it. You can't manipulate the lighting. You can't really frame the image. You can't tell your subject to, hey, move over there, or, you know, there's no masking. You know, the imagery and the body of work that I'm working with, you know, it's a personal, vulnerable body of work. It's referencing, you know, my struggles with food, my struggles with bodies. And by using a scanner, there's no way to mask that. There's no way to hide those quote-unquote imperfections of, you know, certain societal ideals of bodies.
If I can stop you again, it's a very intimate, there's some very intimate sexually themed images in the series, and which is what I think you're referring to. And the scanner, and maybe you can sort of clarify that a little bit. This is you're actually scanning three-dimensional images?
Right.
Or three-dimensional objects?
Right, exactly. Yeah, so... you know, I'm drawn to specific objects sometimes. Like, for instance, I know when you came out to our show, you were talking about the One Piece Happy Cherries, which is an image of a bunch of gummy cherries. And, you know, I can't help but look at the image and kind of like salivate. And you know, when I was making the body of work, I'm sitting there and I'm eating this entire bag of gummies and they're absolutely just terrible and they're disgusting. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, why am I eating this whole bag of cherries that, you know, has no nutritional value? It's really not satisfying. It feels like my teeth are rotting. And that, I guess, was, you know, a bit of a jumping off point to kind of continue this search for objects for me that kind of act as a juxtaposition between my struggles with, you know, food and body image, and also kind of tongue in cheek with some sexual nature of the subject matter as well. And happy cherries can, you know, cherries, cherry pie, popping the cherry. These are all kind of, you know, references, you know, modern references to, you know, sexuality. But for me, it means, you know, it means a lot more than that. There's definitely different layers that are revealed to it. And having those images paired up with, you know, images of panties that are stained, or a birth control pack with, you know, mid-month, there's still a pill there, and you're, you know, that's titled God Damn It. You know, there's certain humor to it, but it's also a reality. And it's also, I think, and I hope, relatable to some people in ways where they can look at it and, you know, there's familiarity in a stained pair of underwear. There's, you know, there's comfort in it almost. Like, everyone has this relation to it, but putting it out there, you know, it's vulnerable for me, but it's also cathartic in a way. And by using the scanner, you know, I can't hide those details. You know, I was looking at the image stained, which is the picture of panties paired with some cigarettes, and, you know, I noticed that there's a piece of hair from my dog in there. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, that's one thing I didn't notice. But now I guess, you know, it's there for the world to see. And that, I think, is really powerful because, you know, I'm not trying to enhance features. I'm not trying to,
You're not photo styling.
Yeah, I'm not photoshopping.
The dog hair, right? That shows up unexpectedly.
Yeah, couldn't plan that. You know, there's no Photoshop, there's no post-production, everything is done in the image. And, you know, instead of, you know, maybe I'm magnifying those imperfections, but I think that I'm embracing those flaws in a way, and I'm kind of celebrating them. So my choice of using the scanner bed, which is, you know, meant for documents to pick up just, you know, two-dimensional objects, you know, it adds a different depth by scanning these three-dimensional objects that, you know, I choose to kind of use as a storytelling tool.
Are you able to, do you go back in once that image is scanned, or is there any further manipulation of the image beyond that?
Yeah, no, there's none. The only thing I do is, you know, if there's some heavy blacks in there, that I just I take out the dust or anything that looks a little distracting. So nothing is post, that's kind of a criteria that I have for making. I don't use post-production. I don't use Photoshop. I'm not using it to layer anything. So everything is done in the actual exposure, which sometimes takes up to 10 minutes because I'm scanning at such a high resolution, which allows me to kind of play with the image. So the exposure, instead of a click on a camera, you know, is this, you know, a bit longer. It allows me to kind of give agency up to the technology and allow it to kind of do its thing. I can't manipulate the lighting on it. It's a set lighting. So I'm choosing different objects like gummy candies or metallic papers that I think can play with that light and add just a tad more dimensionality, even though it's, you know, it's flat, you're using a flatbed scanner, that I think are really interesting. So I try and use those.
Some of the pieces in the show, in the series, are very real, as you pointed out. Others are very beautiful, are strikingly beautiful. The I'll show you yours if you show me mine. Do I have it right?
Yep, that's
with
right.
With the clementines or the tangerines.
Yeah.
The you know, the bright colors and the dark background. The happy cherries is a beautiful piece. I mean,
thank you.
You tell the story of this kind of pedestrian event of eating too much candy, but the fact is the image, the colors are very jewel-like and they almost look metallic.
Right.
In the scanner, are these sometimes happy accidents? I mean, did you expect when you scanned the contents of a bag of gummy candy that you'd get something that could almost look like you know, precious metal or jewels, or would be striking and beautiful at that level? Is there any way of knowing that's going to happen?
Yeah, I leave a lot up to chance, and I think that's exciting. I think I'm drawn to certain colors or textures. I'm a very tactile person. And I think that, you know, I was doing a bunch of research after this case of the, you know, empty bag of gummies on just oral fixations and how some people who are struggling with eating disorders or something like that, which I'm lucky to not be struggling with, but some people, they choose their choices of food by crunchiness or gumminess, or it's an oral fixation that, regardless of nutrition, it's just this thing that they're craving or feeling that their body needs these in different ways. And I think that that kind of brought me to exploring different materials as well. And with the clementine piece, I'll show you yours if you show me mine. It's a grid of clementines and half open and placed down on the scanner and the glass, and they reminisce kind of, you know, for me it was reminiscent of, after it was scanned, female genitalia, which might have not been my exact intention when I first started it. But when it was lined up and it was put together with different images, it really represented, you know, just this array of beauty. And there's, you know, there's, you can tell that there's the stickiness and juiciness of the clementines there still. That's all left behind. There's residue. And I like that there's that kind of that trail of, okay, someone put this here and it, you know, it's not perfect and it's sticky and it's messy, and there's an order to it because it's in a grid, but it's in a way that, you know, you never know how that would look until the image is done, until the image is captured.
You sort of played a hunch a little bit and, you know, put yourself into a, gave yourself an opportunity to come up with something like that. Jill, you talked about venturing, I'm not remembering your precise words, but about sort of crossing a threshold and stepping into the unknown a little bit. Is that something that you feel compelled to do each time out, or is that sort of unknown element sort of meaningful to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's really the reason that I make anything. Because I see that as essentially, like, I guess the biggest thing I could possibly do as a human being is to constantly sort of, like, push myself out of my perceptual biases. And the studio, in that sense, or, like, my paintings become sort of my laboratory, and being able to do that because it's this place where I can sort of bring these things that are pretty ephemeral outside of myself, that are oftentimes my own internal maps or my own ways of understanding reality, and it's a way to sort of concretize them, like put them into this concrete form that I can then look at and respond to in a new way. And I think so much of my practice of painting, it's like it's a building up, but it's also a tearing back down. So it's sort of like I can't really stay where I'm at. Like even right now, I mean, I just hung that show and I have those paintings up, and I'm already sort of pushing past those boundaries in the studio already. It's like I'm sort of using what I was doing there and that type of buildup and then sort of painting back over it, or like scrubbing it down and sort of removing it, in the sense of like, I know I can't stay there. Like I can't stay in that mode of operation. Like it's like I always have to be pushing in to what I don't know yet. And for me, that's really essentially like what I want to achieve with painting, like both as a practice and both as sort of like the residue that ends up in the paint. Because I think the painting itself is really just a document of what I'm going through in the studio. Like it's a residue of that experience. And I mean, they're documents. And sometimes I go back and I'm like, this really isn't working. Like it's time to let go of it. And so I think like loss really becomes a big part of my process, in that like even when I think I've sort of like air quotes, like achieved something, or like that it's a success, it's like, it's only a success to the point that it takes me somewhere new. And if it stops taking me somewhere new, then it's like time to let it go.
I think people outside the art world imagine a sort of unmoving target for the artist, that this is what I'm going to do, this is what I'm going to create, and it's going to look exactly like this. And the two of you obviously both know that that's not the case, that sometimes you start out with an idea or even just a feel, maybe an energy, and it's all right to sort of ride that wave. Yeah. Does that make sense? To sort of not know precisely what an outcome is going to be?
Yeah, I can talk a bit about that. I think that leaving your practice open to experimentation and absolute failure is part of your process. I think that if you're trying to start making work or creating, or you're in your studio and you think, all right, I want to, you know, make this image, and I have this idea in my head. And oftentimes it does start like that with me. I have this idea of this image, and then, you know, you try to make it over and over and over, and you're trying to capture it constantly, and it just isn't happening. But then when you let go of that preconceived notion of what it's supposed to look like, you end up with something honestly more genuine at times, because it's something that, you know, you're working towards, and it comes out more naturally than trying to force it and trying to force an end result. I don't know, Jill, if you feel similar to that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the other part of it for me is, like, success and failure are sort of like their value systems, and they're sort of measurements that I've learned to create. So oftentimes what I perceive to be a failure at first can actually be like a greater success, because oftentimes I'm viewing it as a failure because it doesn't match up with my expected version of reality or what I thought I wanted or what I thought I needed to achieve to succeed. But it's like, I think, like what Candace is saying, it's like you have to sort of be open to something new happening. And I think that's really the magic in the process of art making is that despite like everything I think I know about painting or making in any way, it's like new stuff always finds a way to come through. And I think that's what also makes it like experimental, like being in a laboratory. You know, it's like there's all these variables, and it's sort of like you set certain things up, but then it's like you're really looking for the unexpected.
Maybe when someone designs a new car or a new product, we wouldn't sort of look sideways at, oh, hey, I thought I was going to do this, but then at some point I decided to sort of call an audible and put something, this part doesn't look the way, I mean, no one would think twice about that. So there's really no reason why an artist shouldn't have the freedom to sort of explore the way the two of you have and do. Candace, you teach art in Portland public schools. What for young people, for people who are just starting out as artists or maybe have aspirations as artists or even just want to make some art, what do you tell them about, look, just let it fly? I mean, you're going to make mistakes. None of it constitutes a failure. Is that a message? Is that an important message for people who are trying to make art?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that comes from an honest admittance, because I often feel that, you know, I'm stuck or I can't make, or, you know, nothing I'm producing is quote unquote good enough or what have it. And then there's also lulls where you feel completely uncreated and creative and you're not working. And with students, I see, you know, that the frustration also comes, but it should be the one place where you feel like you can't fail, where you can kind of just use it as this outlet for whatever it may be. It could be meditation. It could be frustration. It could be, you know, again, to go back to tactility, you know, finger painting, work with materials, build something. You know, if you sit there and you get an easel out, or you sit there or with a camera, you know, and you're learning this new device and you're learning this new skill, be it novice or expert, you know, you're gonna, at the end of that class or the end of your studio time, you're gonna have something. There's gonna be something that is created out of your effort that you're putting in, and I think that's really encouraging, especially for students who maybe feel like they can't achieve that in other subjects in classrooms.
And Jill, you're sort of the painter among us. If I start out and, hey, I love the coast, I'm going to paint the, you know, waves crashing on the rocks, and then I decide, well, that looks terrible. That doesn't look anything like waves crashing on rocks. Where do I go? What do you tell me? I mean, what's my next move?
Well, that's a tricky question.
Or do you ever find yourself in that position where you think, oh, I had sort of this notion in my head and it's just not showing up? Where do you go?
Definitely. I mean, that's constantly happening. And I think that's just a big part of the process, is realizing that the process is going to work on you as much as you work on it. And sort of, I think, like, so much in making is just, it is about letting go, like Candace mentioned. And it's sort of letting go of, like, what I think something is supposed to be. So it's sort of like letting go of my idea of the world, letting go of like my value system, perhaps, or like learning to reevaluate in terms of a different mode of usefulness. Like if I'm finding that my idea of an ocean painting just isn't working out, it's like, I mean, either I can sort of give up and just decide like I'm a failure and this isn't working, or I can let go of like what I thought success looked like or what it was or what a painting's supposed to be or what I'm supposed to be or what an ocean is, and sort of actually be present with what is actually happening rather than sort of suspending myself out of what is real, what is here right now, and putting myself into this like illusory world of what ifs or what could be's.
Right. You had Candace?
And I think what's valuable about this show, having Jill and I's work together, although at first glance it may look very disparate, like, you know, Jill's work is a different medium, it's painting, it's a different color scheme, my work's a lot more, a bit more colorful on the spectrum, but that I think is really valuable because you can walk into the show and you can look at it in one way, but the longer that you stay with it, I think Jill and I both talked about this slow read of our works. Jill kind of invites, and I don't want to speak on your behalf, but what I've read from speaking with you, you invite the viewer to kind of move around your painting, to look at it, to come back, to walk away, to see it in a different light. And I think with my work as well, it's great to hear reads on the work that, you know, they're looking at it in one way, and they might walk through the gallery, see my work, see your work, and then go back to it again and then have this different read. Whereas, you know, at first, okay, there's a bunch of clementines, and then you see it next to a triptych of vibrators, and then you go back and you're looking at, you know, a cupcake smashed on, and you're like, well, okay, what, you know, at first, you know, maybe this is just like this candy coated, very simple, straightforward imagery. Same with your paintings. Maybe it's just, you know, this abstract painting. And then you start looking at the work together, and I think they start having this really interesting conversation where it has a lot more layers. And then, you know, maybe you read artist statements, maybe you don't. Most people go in and out of the, you know, looking at the work without having to read any literature. And I think it's important to kind of put work up that might at first glance not look like, you know, they're similar, like it's the same artist. And I think that's really valuable and perceive. And I thank Tessa Heck for that, because she curated us together, having separate studio visits and finding that underlining theme, which I'm, you know, I'm grateful for.
Right. Let's talk about Killjoy for a second. Neither one of you is an actual member of Killjoy Collective, which, as we mentioned before, is a community of local women artists. Tessa Heck curated the current show, Perceive, and I guess you've said, you know, you've identified her role in sort of recognizing this, the value of this pairing. Is that, as non-members of Killjoy, what other sort of benefits have you enjoyed by sort of your association with the collective? Whether it's interacting with other artists or any resources that they, what is Killjoy Collective doing for sort of local women artists at this point?
Well, I'd say a big part. I mean, they're all artists themselves, so they're all makers, and then they've really created this space where they're they're showcasing local female identifying artists, which is, I think, pretty unusual. Like, I don't, you know, and even in a historical context, I mean, we haven't seen that a lot.
Neither one of you is a member of Killjoy Collective, which we described before as a community of local women artists. Beyond Tessa's skilled work at curating this show, putting the two of you together, what other meaning does Killjoy have for local artists?
Yeah, I think the fact that it's a space run by women who are all makers, they all work in different mediums. You've got painters, sculptors, performance artists, video artists. It's really an eclectic group of women. And we had met them because Jill and I both went to PNCA, and all those women are PNCA alum as well from the MFA Visual Studies.
Pacific Northwest College of Art.
Yes, sorry. sorry. And I had graduated a year before those women and Tessa, so that's how I had a relationship with them. And once they graduated, they created this space because they felt like they needed a space to show. And it wasn't just themselves, although they do showcase themselves and each other. They wanted this space to kind of exist in a community that is very accepting, but also that is, you know, inviting to experimental works or maybe, you know, my work isn't something that you were going to put in your living room and, you know, have happy thoughts when you look at maybe. But I don't need to make work like that. I don't feel like I need to, in order to show in Portland or in order to show in a city or just have my work out there to people, that it needs to, you know, have these certain set of standards. So I feel that Killjoy is a space that really is allowing artists to make what they're making and not make for their gallery. Like, with the, you know, Tessa had studio visit with me and had a studio visit with Jill and was like, I love what you guys are working on. I want to show your work. And that is really encouraging and inspiring. And I'm really grateful for a space like that to exist.
Our guests today have been Jill Falk and Candace Jan, who are showing their work in... who are showing their work at Killjoy Collective, 222 Southeast 10th. It opened this past weekend. It will be there through October 7th. Jill, Candace, thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. It was really fun.
My name is Eric Bartels. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO-FM 90.7 Community Radio.